This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, our theme is suicide. So with our guest, we do get into some depth about a suicide attempt he made and many times he was feeling suicidal through his life. If this is something that may affect you, please visit our website, mentalpodcast.co.uk, for a list of places you can get support. Alternatively, if this may be something uncomfortable for you to listen to, this episode may be one to give a miss. However, it is a brilliant episode and I'm really looking forward to playing it in a moment. First up, we've got a few stats. So these are from the Samaritans. In 2017, there were 6,213 suicides in the UK and Republic of Ireland. This means approximately one death by suicide every 2 hours. Let's pause on that one before we get into any more, because I feel like the suicide statistics are so massive, but particularly when we look at them compared to some of our other statistics, the tens or hundreds of thousands, that can seem low. But actually, I like when it's qualified by things like that, a suicide every 2 hours.
Yeah. And it's like by the time you've had an average night's sleep, 4 people will have committed suicide in that time. And that really puts that into perspective, I think.
Yeah, just qualifying it like that can bring it suddenly very close to home.
Yeah.
It is still an incredibly alarming figure. It's still way higher than it should be. And I think also important to know is that for many mental illnesses, this is what people refer to as the final symptom. So this is the worst you can possibly get is ending up dying by suicide. So for all the 6,213 from last year, there'll be many, many more people that luckily didn't get to that stage, but this is still a risk for.
Absolutely.
Further to that, we've got some more statistics from Samaritans. In the UK, men remain 3 times as likely to take their own lives as women, and in the Republic of Ireland, 4 times more likely.
Gosh.
Yeah, and that's one that sort of confirms certain suspicions for me around the culture in Ireland that I'm obviously familiar with. And when I visit family, I'm very aware that the man-up culture that we have here is even worse there.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised. But also, every time I hear these statistics, I'm so shocked, and yet I'm not surprised by this one. And yet somehow still shocked. You know, it's a strange feeling to try and explain.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know the statistics, you're not surprised by the severity of them, but they're still shocking all the same.
Yeah, why am I not shocked? You know, sometimes it's like when you see things in the newspapers and you think, this should shock me more, but I think we're really deadened as a society generally, because so many awful things are happening that it's just like, what thing do I focus on? What awful thing do I sympathize with?
And that's something that, for a very different example, happens a lot in retail. People can get overwhelmed by their options. So that's why a lot of stores put things like in clothes, for example, they put it into color palettes, or they organize things in certain ways so that the store looks a lot simpler. But actually behind the racks, there's a lot more sizes and clothes. I think that happens with everything. So we can see so many horrors going on around the world to the extent where we don't know where to start.
Where do we start? Where do we even begin?
It's a real problem. And so I'm glad that at least we have our niche. So I can see all these horrors happening over the world, but I have somewhere to start because I have my niche of help, and I'm probably not help on many things, but when it comes to mental health, at least I'm doing something.
Sure.
Another statistic is from the BBC that we've mentioned before, and that is that suicide is the biggest killer of men under the age of 50 in the UK. Again, that relates into what we said with the previous statistic, but it's still such a problem.
I've heard this one so many times. I know that suicide is the biggest killer of men under 50. You know, I work in mental health awareness. Like, I've heard that statistic so many times that it never gets easier to hear.
In a different way, I sometimes find that hard to reconcile, because I absolutely believe the statistic, and I've seen plenty of examples that would confirm it. Yet sure. Because suicide is so little talked about, you can forget what big a threat that is.
Yeah.
You know, and particularly for someone like myself with experience of mental illness, I'm likely to be even higher at risk than that. You know, luckily I'm not suicidal myself, but I would have more risk factors than some people. And
sure.
Yet I'm bombarded a lot by, you know, adverts about cancer and like heart disease letters and all kinds of things that seem far more present in our society as here are things that that exist and could kill me.
Yeah.
And, you know, thank God for the Samaritans, because often they're the only ones talking about suicide in certain environments, like when you go to train stations, they've got the posters up.
And for free. I think that's such an amazing thing, is that they're offering their services. It's run by volunteers. I think that they're absolutely incredible service. I recommended them literally yesterday to somebody. Somebody is posting on my timeline some stuff that made me think, ooh, that doesn't sound quite right. And I sent them a message to say, I hope you're okay, but if you're not, then please do call the Samaritans, 116123, I think, off the top of my head. And he sent me a message this morning saying, thank you. I went to the gym, which has been really helpful. And we're now started a bit of a dialogue just about how he's feeling.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really valuable resource to just have in your back pocket to be able to whip out and say, look, mate, I know what it is to be where you are, and these people can help you, and I care. You know, I think it's so important to let people know that you understand, not that you're trying to fix them or save them or change them in any way, but just to say, hey, like, I get it.
Yeah.
I know what you feel like. And I know that when you're feeling terrible, you think, well, you can't possibly know what I feel like. And that's why I think as well, the work that Time to Change does is so valuable, because all of their volunteers have lived experience.
Right. We don't always have to have the direct experience either, but trying to understand.
No, yeah, absolutely. Sorry. Yeah.
Is half the battle as well. So I, having been a Samaritan volunteer myself, learned so much about suicide, learned so much about grief, learned so much about relationships that I hadn't experienced. With that in mind, I feel the need to give Samaritans a little bit of a plug.
Myself. I think this has turned into a total Samaritan plug, but I think they deserve it, you know.
So
I'm volunteering in Calais for Christmas, but I'm already thinking about the next thing that I can do, and I think Samaritans is definitely going to be on my list. I'd love to do something for Samaritans or sit on the phones like you did. I would think that would be a wonderful thing to do.
It's something to be a part of, really. You feel the change that you're making. And I don't think you can say that for every place that you could volunteer. So if you do want to call them, it's 116123 in the UK or Republic of Ireland. And that number is completely free. Samaritans don't get charged for it. You don't get charged for it. And also, it won't show up on your bill. So if you call them from your home landline, that will never show up on the bill either. They do everything they can for that confidentiality. And having been part of the service, I can confirm the lengths they go to internally to protect confidentiality as well. If any of this does affect you, they're a wonderful service. And equally, if it doesn't, they're not just for talking about suicide. A lot of people think that's the case, but actually they are trained to talk about all sorts of things. So I had a lot of calls in my time about grief. I had a lot about relationships. I had a lot about all sorts of homelessness. So we're not going to be shocked by something you say. And it's a 24-hour service, so there'll always be someone to pick up the phone. So now we've talked a little bit about Samaritans, we'll get back into some more statistics from them. I wanted to finish up with statistics about how suicide is on the increase / decrease, just to get an idea of where we are now going into today in this episode. So suicide in young men in Scotland increased for the third consecutive year in 2017. There has been a significant decrease in male suicide in the UK as a whole, and the male suicide rate is at the lowest over 30 years. Rates in the Republic of Ireland have fluctuated more than the UK in recent years, but it is currently at its lowest since 1989.
Oh.
So there's some nice statistics to finish up on, because other than the one about Scotland, all of the rates in those are going down. So that's, whilst there's still so much more work to do and the stigma is very much alive and kicking, it's lovely to know that change is coming.
It
is
the work happening. That we're doing is paying off.
Yeah, gradually. So we'll get into the episode shortly. Did you have any more thoughts you wanted to share on this?
No, not at all. I think this has been a really beautiful intro. I really enjoyed it.
Good. Active feedback. Thank you. So the guest this week is Johnny Benjamin. He is an MBE awarded campaigner and writer. So he's written a book we'll, surprise, surprise, recommend in a minute. Also has done all kinds of programming for BBC and Channel 4 and currently goes around schools talking about mental health. So he's a very busy guy. Luckily, he found some time to come in and speak to us, which was lovely. And one more thing I want to mention with him as well is we mention his diagnosis in the episode schizoaffective disorder, in case you don't know what that is. It's quite an overarching condition diagnosis, which includes symptoms similar to that of bipolar and also that of schizophrenia. So it can include mood changes, whether that's having loads of depressive periods or whether that's similar to bipolar, having depressive and manic periods interchanging. It also includes some psychotic symptoms where you may be seeing things that aren't there, hearing things that aren't there. And so it's not a dual diagnosis, but those are the two conditions that it's often compared to because it tends to take on the symptoms of both. However, because the symptoms for this condition are so broad, it also presents in people very differently, and therefore often it is diagnosed later in life. So hopefully that gives you a bit of context on what we talk about in the episode. It is a extra long bumper episode we have for you today. Johnny is just full of insight, and so yeah, I couldn't help but want to speak to him for hours. So we'll get into that episode in just a moment, but first, this week's Audible recommendation.
I'm recommending The Stranger on the Bridge by Johnny Benjamin and Britt Flugler. The Stranger on the Bridge is a memoir of the journey Johnny has made both personally and publicly to not only find the person who saved his life, but also to explore how he got to the bridge in the first place and how he continues to manage his diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder. Using extracts from diaries Johnny's been writing from the age of 13, this book is a deeply personal memoir with a unique insight on mental health. To listen to your first book free with Audible, follow our link at bit.ly/mentalbooks.
The link and details are in the description for this episode.
So my name is Johnny Benjamin, and I first went to see a child psychologist when I was about 4. And my parents had taken me to see a doctor a few times because I'd stopped sleeping properly. And I became very anxious and became a bit violent as well. So I don't think I could communicate this at the time, but I was seeing things that weren't there. I was hearing things that weren't there. I was very scared. And so my parents took me to doctor, eventually to this child psychologist. And I remember working with this child psychologist for a while. Yeah.
So may I just ask with that, what sort of things were you seeing at that point?
I'd seen the film The BFG, Roald Dahl's The BFG.
Love it.
Well, I didn't, because I started to see what I thought was The BFG, and it really scared me. And I would go to bed at night and I would see The BFG and I would hear things that weren't there. I thought The BFG was walking around the streets and came into my house. So I'd hear, you know, footsteps on the stairs that weren't there. And yeah, and that's why I stopped wanting to sleep, because every time I went to bed, I had these things happen. Couldn't really communicate that. I think I was just scared. I didn't understand what was going on. Yeah, became more anxious, became violent because I was scared and just didn't understand what was happening. And then I worked with this child psychologist for a while. But I don't remember what happened in our sessions. So obviously, it was a long time ago. Yeah, I saw her for a while. And she eventually got me back into a kind of sleep routine, back into my own bed.
Good.
Yeah. But I don't know how she did it, but she did.
And did you find it easier to communicate with her what was going on than family?
I remember her, actually. I can still picture her, and I was kind of scared of her. She didn't help.
Right.
So, yeah, I just remember, being scared of her.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, because she's someone new. You're only really young, and you're there, especially to talk to her about things that scare you.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true, yeah. I wish I could remember what happened in our sessions together. I don't even know how many sessions I had with her. I can't remember. Me and my parents never talked about it. Never kind of had any discussions about what was going on or what it was like. Or I think everyone was just a bit nervous talking about it. Yeah, it was weird. I would just go to these appointments every week and that was it.
Well, it's nice that your family felt comfortable going and seeking the support with you, even if they didn't feel able to have a conversation about it.
Yeah, no, definitely. So my parents used to obviously come in with me to see the lady that I saw. And yeah, I wish I could remember. I wish I had the reports from, because I'd be really intrigued to see what was said in those sessions. All I've got is one letter. I went through my medical records. I've just got one letter from the doctor to the child psychologist saying, you need to see this young boy. And that's it. I wish I knew what was said in those sessions, but I'll never know.
Yeah. And sometimes you don't need to if you've got, by the sounds of it, what you went in for out of it. Your sleep did improve. And so how did things go from there? So you're sleeping a bit better, you went to more of a routine.
I was always very anxious as a child. I found things overwhelming. I found the world overwhelming. And then I started primary school and I always felt very different. I went to an all boys primary school.
Right.
And I just felt like I couldn't really fit in. A lot of the boys there were into sport. I was never into sport. Mm-hmm. And so
me neither.
Okay. Okay. I don't know about you, but I just spent a lot of time on my own, break times on my own. I would always just be in the library reading books on my own.
I remember from quite a young age having this kind of almost third party perspective. For as long as I could remember, I'd sort of see my interactions with other people as if I wasn't in the scene. And I think that sort of can lend itself to a bit of social isolation.
Yeah.
That you're thinking about everything from afar and therefore you're less in the thick of life itself.
Yeah. What age were you in?
I don't think I really remember actually before maybe 10 or so. I don't remember that young,
really?
But I don't remember not doing that.
Okay.
But it got better with time.
Yeah. I was great in terms of being in the classroom. I was academic and I enjoyed the stuff I was learning about. But it was outside of the classroom where, I don't know, I just found it really difficult to fit in. And just, as I said, we just used to spend times on my own in the library, but no one ever sort of picked up on it, really, or questioned it.
It's interesting how these things can be so easily missed.
Yeah.
This is a slightly different example, but I had dyslexia, and that was not picked up in my first school at all.
Yeah.
They were keeping me behind in my breaks and my lunches because I wasn't keeping up with my work, but no one seemed to ask why. So it was actually my mum intervening was how I got the diagnosis for that.
Obviously do a lot of work in schools now, and I just think, I think there's more awareness now.
Yeah, definitely.
But people just still, teachers don't know what to do or how to talk about it or...
Absolutely. It's almost like two sides. The way I see it, there's like one side is that they don't have enough knowledge.
Yeah.
And so they don't feel prepared for that. But then also, I think there is a lot of this mentality of opening a can of worms.
Yeah.
And that comes from lack of knowledge as well, that they think, oh, if I ask about this, I don't know where it will go,
absolutely.
I don't have the skills. And that's as much about supporting teachers as it is as supporting kids.
Yeah, for sure. But I do think things definitely, in some schools, have got better. But for me, emotions, thoughts, it just never talked about, growing up in school. Just, it was all about the academic side of things. And I did well academically throughout my whole school career. So everyone just thought I was great, you know, because I was doing well academically.
Because you are your grades.
Oh, yeah, I know. And then I moved to secondary school. And
so, may I just, before we get in secondary school, you've mentioned there that sport was a way that you noticed separation between you and others.
Yeah.
A lot of the guys at school were more interested than you were. In terms of what was going on in your mind, were you aware of those kind of differences at that point?
Definitely, yeah. My mum, when I was six, she put me into these drama classes to out of school to try and build my confidence, because I wasn't very confident and I didn't follow sport. So she thought, well, let's try you in drama. And I loved it. I loved it. I got to be someone else, another character, and I really thrived there. It was a really sporty school, so I really didn't get on too well with that at all. I was always more into drama and books. And
yeah. And I think sometimes it can feel a bit like you're being set up to fail when you're in that kind of environment. Yeah. You immediately know, I'm not going to be able to keep up on the sports front.
Yeah.
Whereas when you had those acting classes, you then get to be someone else. Yeah. And it totally removes that.
Absolutely.
Because if you're playing a character, it doesn't matter what people think of the character, because it's a character.
Exactly.
It's a mask for you.
Exactly. And and the whole escapism of it. You know, loved the whole escapism of... that was my favourite time of the week, was going to my drama classes and escapism of, becoming someone else. It was my favourite thing to do.
Yeah, and did you find that helped?
Massively. It definitely helped as I grew up in terms of, that ability to escape. So as things became more difficult, you know, that ability to escape just for an hour, 2 hours, it was just... something I really needed.
And so you were going to tell me about secondary school.
Yeah, so I moved to secondary school, and I went to a really, really big Jewish secondary school. That was even more overwhelming, because I'd gone from a really small primary school to a really massive secondary school. And the same thing happened there at first. I found it really hard to fit in, and I felt really lost, I remember, at first, because it was just so big and... so overwhelming. No one prepared me for that transition. And I think there's a link between that, finding that whole period difficult, and then me starting to hear a voice in my head. I think there's a link between that. But also, there was two things. I started secondary school. I also lost my gran as well. And that was the first time I'd experienced grief. And I found that really tough. But again, it wasn't, especially in coming from the Jewish community, like you bury someone like straight after, the day after. It's like, right, okay, well, you've done your mourning. Do you know what I mean? Like, done the mourning, right, go back to normal life. And I was like, I just couldn't do that. I was really close to her, and I really struggled with the grief. And I think that, and the whole transition period, I think there's a link between that and then hearing this voice.
It's interesting. That sounds particularly tricky to me, because I'd already lost some grandparents before getting to secondary school. And so you seem there a bit old to go through that ritual and everyone know what their part is in the funeral and in grieving. And you're this 11-year-old, so you have enough understanding to know what's going on, but you don't quite know what your part is in this. You've never been through that before.
No. Yeah, it's strange time. And especially with this transition to secondary school. Yeah, really strange time. And I found comfort in this voice. So I thought there was an angel that was talking to me. It was... so I was very influenced by my religion growing up. I went to Sunday school, and then I went to this Jewish secondary school. Yeah, really influenced by what I was learning about, and I used to pray every day. And so it almost felt like this guardian angel, and it felt good. It was like sort of protecting me and watching over me, and a friend when I needed it. But I just assumed that everyone had this voice, you know, that would talk to them, this kind of character.
Right.
Angels. I just thought it was something we didn't really talk about. So, yeah, there was that. And there was also around that time I saw the film The Truman Show.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a massive influence on me. And I had a best friend actually at the time. I saw it with him. And after we saw it, he started saying to me, well, you know, what if you're in the Truman Show? You know, you could be in the Truman Show and I could be an actor, he said. You know, this, it really played on my mind, and I began to misinterpret things. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I would be at home and I would look out the window, you know, onto the street, and there would just be someone innocently walking past, fine. And then I'd go back and just look out the window like 5 hours later, and that same person would be walking back, and I'd be like, that's too much of a coincidence, you know. Just like in the Truman Show, everything is planted, isn't it? Everything is directed by this production team.
Right.
You know, and I was like, well, obviously this person is planted. And just then began to sort of, yeah, believe there were cameras that were watching me, and I was on this kind of TV show. And I liked it, actually, because I did feel invisible in school. As I said, it was such a massive school, so many people. I was just lost. I felt lost in the school. And again, even though I was doing well academically, just, I don't know, it was just, yeah, felt invisible. So I thought, well, yeah, but if I'm on this TV show, then people will see me. Mm-hmm. They'll like me, and they'll respect me. And that's what I really wanted. I wanted people to like me, you know. I wasn't really well liked in school. And so, yeah, I was happy. I was happy with this. And it just became sort of a normal part of my existence.
Did you, at the time, think much about why people didn't seem to like you? Or were you perhaps preoccupied with what else was going on for you with the Truman Show scenario?
People used to call me a swot
right.
in school and take the mick out of me. Because I was...
And that's a reflection on my education, that I didn't assume you were busy studying.
I was really focused on my studies and I was really high achieving. And so, yeah, I thought that's why people didn't like me. I was seen as this swot.
Okay, that makes sense.
People used to call me that, yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, it's such a transitional time because you're still figuring out who you are. I think one of the things I found the most jarring at times growing up was figuring out what parts of your experience are just you and what is your peers.
I know, yeah.
And you're through puberty, you're going through that enough as it is without also dealing with mental illness and figuring out what parts of this are me and everyone else.
Yeah, it's a confusing time, such a confusing time, especially when you hit puberty. And I hit puberty really early, and that was really, for me, that was really embarrassing. And again, I thought it was a reason why people didn't like me, the boys didn't like me, because I hit puberty really, really early. And I used to do things like I would, because I started to get hair in places, I would cut the hair off me, not realizing that it would obviously grow back quicker and thicker. I just wanted to fit in. And so I used to do things like that.
And yet the fun irony is we all feel that same way, just from a different angle.
Yeah.
Most things were on a fairly usual schedule, but my voice broke really late, like not until I was 17.
Wow.
And so that was something I was really conscious of.
Yeah.
So I would have liked to have been more your speed.
Yeah. And again, no one talked about it. That's the thing. No one talked about puberty and the changes that you go through. And I just wish someone would have just talked about it, you know?
Yeah, it's funny looking back, isn't it, what is and isn't mentioned.
Yeah.
So I remember being told about mood swings, but not how to deal with them.
Yeah, right?
Like, it was just, oh, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
We won't tell you how to recognise them. We won't tell you how to deal with them. Your parents might just be annoyed with you a bit more.
Yeah, it's weird. It's so weird, actually, looking back. It's really weird. We got one lesson of sex education and it was how to put a condom on. And that was it, really, to be honest. Really weird, looking back.
It's almost one of those things where you wonder, how did they teach such a lesson and leave so much out?
Yeah.
How did they possibly explain it?
I think, again, it's like you say, like opening up a can of worms.
Mm.
Just people are just afraid of opening up a can of worms and having to deal with things they're not comfortable dealing with. I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, well, it's such a clear contrast because I remember at certain points when sex education was progressing in legislation, then there'd be this backlash of, oh, if you teach this,
yeah, exactly,
all the kids will be fucking at 12. Like,
yeah.
And that's not the reality.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And then it happens today, you know, when I go into schools and talk to a head teacher about mental health and they say, well, you know, what happens if you create more mental health issues, or you spread, you know, ideas about mental health, or...
Yeah, it's crazy because there's surely no kid in that class that's like, right. Ooh, depression, that sounds fun. Well,
yeah, absolutely. Like,
that's cool. I want a bit of that.
Yeah, it's weird. It's such a weird mentality. Such a weird mentality. But it still persists. Yeah. Today. That's the thing. Need to get rid of that.
Yeah, I'm so glad it's getting better. Though. Yeah. We might come back to that. So back to where we are with you. So you're in secondary school.
Things for me got... Well, they changed. They got more difficult in my mid-teens. I started getting acne probably around 14, 15. And yeah, it got really bad. And we tried different like creams and stuff, lotions and from the doctors. And eventually they put me on this medication, Roaccutane. They said to me, when they gave it to me, they said, it's linked to depression. You know, there's a risk of depression. And I didn't really understand what depression was. We didn't talk about it again. I didn't understand it. But then about like 6 months after taking it, I just began to get these really persistent low moods. I was tearful. There was no reason. Well, there seemed to be no reason why I would get tearful and feel so low. For me, I said to myself, I don't understand, because I come from a really loving family and I was doing well in my GCSEs, you know? So in my head, it just didn't make sense what was going on.
And it's that mentality that's put on us of, I'm a man and I'm crying. There must be something wrong.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
that can't be acceptable.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when I was growing up, I was very tearful. I used to cry a lot growing up, like when I was really young. And I remember people started saying to me, come on, you know, big boys don't cry now. You know, man up. And that's the message that I started to get in primary school. So... I never felt comfortable being vulnerable or showing my emotions. And obviously that caused me a lot of issues when I started to get a depression. And throughout my mid to late teens, I used to cry a lot. But I would always have to hide that, or felt I had to hide that, because, yeah, it wasn't manly.
Mm. Yeah, and then you find yourself worrying about the worry.
Yeah.
It goes on from there.
Yeah, it's a never-ending spiral, self-destruction. I didn't want to tell anyone what was going on. As I said, I was doing really well in my GCSEs, and everyone thought, yeah, I was doing really well. And I wanted people to carry on thinking that. I didn't want them to know what was really going on. When I was in school, we didn't ever talk about mental health. The only thing that they did was they showed us the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
Which was...
not helpful.
Not helpful at all. Yeah, that film, I remember watching it because it was, you know, one of those things like it's near the end of term and there's no work to do, so let's just watch a film. And I remember watching that film and just being, it just seemed to really strike a chord with me. That film, it scared me. It put me off talking because I thought I might end up in a place like that. It's a really hopeless film. Really hopeless. It really affected me. And they just showed it to us and they're like, right, okay, done, you know, go to break. And I remember I went to the toilet and just hid in the cubicle all break time because I was just like, what am I going to do? There's something in that film which I can relate to that I can't talk about it. I just felt very lost. Yeah, very, very, very lost. And the longer it went on, the more difficult it became. And as well, I think when it got really hard, so when I was about 16, the voice in my head changed. It went from being this nice voice, this angel, to what I thought was the devil. That's when things became extra difficult because this voice was very critical and would tell me to do things. And I started to have to do the things it told me. Always the things in threes, things I would have to say three times, or touch something three times, and I really felt I had to do these things. And yeah, it just that I don't know how I really got through my teens.
Yeah, fighting your one-man battle.
Yeah, very much alone. Although when I was 17, my best friend at the time, he could really begin to... I was only able to wear a mask for so much of the day, do you know what I mean?
It's exhausting.
Yeah, it's really exhausting. So he could see sometimes when he was with me, I wasn't myself, I was really quiet, and I did tell him bits of what was going on, and eventually he pushed me to see my doctor, which I'm really glad he did, actually, because by this time I was quite desperate, and I went to my doctor, and he was really good, actually. He took it very seriously, and he referred me on to CAMHS, and I went to CAMHS, but I didn't have a great experience at CAMHS. I had an assessment, and I was not in a good place, and they were concerned, and then I didn't hear from them for months, and I remember saying to myself, I don't know, I've just got to do this on my own, just somehow, somehow I have to fight it on my own.
Yeah, and you can find yourself wondering if what's going on is even real.
Yeah.
Am I not sick enough for the help? Yeah. Am I not suicidal enough?
Yeah. Again, looking back, I didn't want to contact them. I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to be a nuisance. I don't want to contact them. I was scared. I was scared of, you know, what would happen. Well, they said that they would contact me straight away, and they didn't. Yeah. So,
and it was so difficult for you to contact them the first time.
Yeah.
You thought you'd handed it over to them.
Yeah, for sure. After I didn't hear back from them for months, I decided in my head I would run away to university, and that would be my saviour. So I would be able to have a new start, and I'd leave the old me behind. I didn't mention, but I think a big part of struggling so much, I was struggling with my sexuality, and coming from a Jewish community, going to a Jewish school, that was hard, you know. Well, I remember one time I was in synagogue, and there was one particular sermon that the rabbi gave, and he talked about how sinful homosexuality was, and I remember wishing the ground would open up, and just, there was so much shame and so much guilt, and there was already that because of my mental health, you know, and feeling, you know, I shouldn't feel like this, but then I also shouldn't feel that way about.
And where were you at with it? Because that's, you know, what the rabbi was preaching. To what extent had you internalized that? Did you also think it's completely wrong? Yeah. It shouldn't be this way?
Yeah, I really did. Well, just like my mental health, I think I was in denial for quite a while. I was like, this can't be happening. This isn't happening. This isn't me. There was a lot of denial.
Well, that's what happens when people tell us something that can be so at the core of who we are is wrong.
Yeah.
That, how do you reconcile that other than denial?
Absolutely.
And that doesn't work out anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when everyone around you is, you know, got that same mentality. In sixth form, there was someone in my year that came out as gay, and he got a lot of stick and abuse and got isolated, and I saw that happening, and it didn't exactly make me want to deal with what was going on. Just wanted to make me suppress things even more, seeing that.
Yeah, well, there can be parallels with that in terms of sexuality and mental health, or more specifically mental illness, where people almost think it's something that catches. Like, if they're around that thing, then it'll become a part of their life.
Yeah, it was scary how people would isolate this. He'd sit on his own every lesson. People just didn't want to be associated with him anymore.
Yeah.
Because he came out. It was so bizarre.
And there's probably a lot of the lads thinking, oh, he's gay, he must fancy me.
Which...
Yeah, because every woman fancies you.
And that weirdly still sort of persists with some people I know in their 30s. It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, because I think... unfortunately, for certain things, unless they do affect you personally, you don't have a need to challenge them.
Yeah.
And so many people I speak to through the podcast had really negative thoughts around mental illness, carried a lot of that stigma inside them, and then it wasn't until they started struggling themselves they were forced to reassess all of that. And I wonder how many of them would go through their whole life never doing that otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the reality is that mental illness does affect all of us.
Absolutely, yeah.
And even if it's not you personally, it's somebody you know.
Yeah.
So to some extent, to hold on to that stigma and that ignorance, you have to be shutting something down in your brain.
Yeah. I just wish that, again, at school, in sixth form, at university, there would have been someone that would have talked about it, you know? There was absolutely nothing. I think it would have made a difference, obviously not just to me, but to everyone. And talked about it's okay to find things difficult and to feel overwhelmed and to struggle with your mental health. It's okay. But there was nothing. There was never anything. Which, yeah, it doesn't make sense. I know lots of people that, you know, went to uni and really struggled, you know, dropped out maybe in the first few weeks or first few months. And everyone was like, these are going to be the best years of your life. You're going to have the best time. You're going to love it. It's amazing. It's amazing. And there's that pressure, isn't there, you know, to then have that time of your life. And when you don't, you feel guilty. And
yeah. And it's that pressure to have that all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're expected to go out and drink and then be hungover, but you can't feel sad when you're hungover. Yeah. You can't feel sorry for yourself.
Yeah. I know. I just wish, again, I just wish someone would have talked about the realities.
And it's funny, isn't it, how in our society, university is really placed as the bastion of education. And yet something that, according to Mind, affects one in four of us every year. They don't understand.
I don't understand it. Because now I know that lots of people around me were struggling, but no one talked about that. It was just like, we all got to go out and drink and look like we're having a great time. And that wasn't the reality for lots of people, which is just sad, I think.
Yeah. And I bet a lot of those same people have told you things they were going through then and they never did at the time.
No, absolutely. And I did drama at university, actually. And
is this me stereotyping, but there'd be a lot of people figuring themselves out?
Oh, my word, yes. But again, like, I really struggled at university. And I started self-harming when I got to university. And people around me on my course saw that. And obviously, people picked me up on it. And, you know, what's going on? I was like, just, you know, it's stressful, whatever. And they were like, yeah, okay, yeah, get it. No, that was the extent of the conversations, really.
I've found a box to categorise that into. Yeah. That's all I need.
Yeah, that's done. Sorted. You're stressed. That's fine. You know, I was very. I just didn't want to let people in. I didn't want people to know the full extent of what was going on. So I was very sort of blasé about it. Yeah, there were lots of behaviours that, you know, I would get drunk on my own and with people, my housemates. I'd be like, yeah, just stress. University stress. Particularly in the second and third years, it was like, and people would be like, okay. I found myself more unable to cope at university. And yeah, self-harm, alcohol. And I was able to isolate myself more at university as well. You know, I could hide away in the library just to avoid seeing people and stay out till really late and, yeah, avoid coming back to my house and having to see my housemates. I could do that at university. So, but again, on my course, I was doing really well. Everyone thought I was doing really well. I remember going to the doctor a few times when I went to university. I saw my student doctor and became more and more desperate. And we tried different antidepressants, but nothing was really addressing everything else going on. And then it came to a climax when I was in my third year, in my final year, and I ended up psychotic. I lost control over what I was saying and doing. I felt I was being possessed. Felt like there was something inside of me. And I ended up one night on the streets screaming, shouting. Very terrifying experience. Just didn't understand what was happening to me. Mm-hmm. I felt very embarrassed. And then I was taken to hospital. And that's when everything came out. And that was excruciatingly embarrassing for me. This mask had now slipped and everyone could see the real me. And just could not deal with that at all. And then I got my diagnosis at that time, schizoaffective disorder. I saw my psychiatrist and a psychiatrist became my psychiatrist. And, you know, he was like, you're not on the Truman Show. And, you know, there is no voice. And you have this condition, and that for me just felt like the end of my world.
Because you'd had so many years on your own coming to terms with your reality, and then that being ripped away, as unhealthy as your reality was,
exactly.
It doesn't exactly, feel so yeah. helpful at the time.
No, and there was just no hope given when I got my diagnosis. It was just like, you've got this, and this is not good. Do you know what I mean? It was never like, you know, we can get you through this, or no one ever said you can overcome this. It was just like, you've got this, and you're really unwell. And yeah, again, when I look back, it is just I think things could have been a bit different.
And it's part of a broader societal problem, isn't it? Because of that stigma, we don't see people being aspirational with mental illness.
No.
We can look at the Paralympics, and if you have a disability physically, you can see how people are pushing the very limits of what they're capable of physically. And that puts them in a category. They're not succeeding despite it. They're succeeding in a category because of that. And there's so many things we have that for. You know, I have dyslexia. I can find lists. I had a book like that when I was growing up. All these wonderful people that have dyslexia that can give me hope and to remind me that I wasn't a lost cause when I sometimes felt I was.
Sure.
So much progress has happened with mental illness, but we don't have that parity.
Particularly, I think, with the condition that I was given, schizoaffective. There were people out there that talked about experiences of depression or bipolar or anxiety, but I'd never heard of schizoaffective, and neither had obviously my family and friends, and it was a scary term, you know, particularly schizophrenia. And that added to my distress and my loss of hope. And it was just downhill from there. Yeah, I was admitted to psychiatric hospital and put on suicide one-to-one for a while, because I was suicidal by that point. It was just really hopeless in the hospital. No one around me was getting any better. There was no encouragement, no hope. I did give up a month into my stay in the hospital. I'd had enough. I reached the limit, and that was the night that I decided that was it. I was going to end my life. That was the only way. It was the only way out of this, and not just for me, but for everyone around me, because I thought I was now this burden on everyone, this person that they would worry about. And when I made the decision this one night, everything just seemed so much calmer suddenly. If it was a relief, if I'm honest, it was a relief, because I was like, there's a way out and I can just do it. So that was the night before. And when the morning came, next morning, I'd made a plan and I went through with the plan, and basically I had the usual morning routine of medication and breakfast, and a psychiatrist came around and saw me for like 2 minutes, and I was like, yeah, fine. And then I suddenly did a cigarette and they let me out to have a cigarette, and I ran away as fast as I could. And yeah, I went to this bridge. Just horrible. I remember still the journey to the bridge from the hospital, and my mind just going a million miles an hour, thinking about family and what I was about to do, and so many different emotions and thoughts, and really overwhelming, really overwhelming. And then getting there to this bridge and going onto the edge. And then out of nowhere, this guy is standing next to me, asking me questions, trying to talk to me. And I remember bits. I don't remember like great detail. I remember trying to get him to go away, because he was, I knew what he was trying to do, and he was distracting me, so I wanted him to go and leave me alone. It quickly became obvious that there was something different about him. He was just very grounded and calm. It's really different to everything I'd experienced in the hospital. In the hospital, I tried to be honest. I tried to say when I felt suicidal, And when I did, it was like, they reacted like, oh, right, right, well, you know, take some medication, we'll take you back to the suicide ward. And, you know, the suicide ward was someone sitting in a chair watching you 24/7 and not talking, just watching. So there was never someone there to really, really, really listen, like really actively listen. And he listened, this guy just had this, yeah, just this presence about him that was really calm. And he was so interested. He was very adamant that he wasn't going anywhere as well. So, well, essentially we struck up a bond, a connection, and I began to feel more and more comfortable with it. As time went on and minutes went by, he kept asking me questions, and I did begin to open up to him, actually, because I felt safe and I felt really listened to and not judged. There was a couple of really key things that he said to me. The first key thing he said was don't be embarrassed. You don't have to feel embarrassed, which I'd never heard anyone say that before. Don't be embarrassed. The whole feeling of embarrassment, just that, because that was the thing that was really weighing down on me, was the embarrassment of everything, my diagnosis and my symptoms and my sexuality, the embarrassment and the shame of everything. But this guy was just really blunt. Don't be embarrassed, it's fine. And hearing that was a real, just a weight off my shoulders, I think, when I heard that. Right. And then I think for me, what really was the second key thing he said, the real key thing, he said to me very kind of, in a very matter-of-fact way, he just said, you'll be all right, you know, you'll get better. It was hearing that, someone actually say that, someone belief that I would get better and have faith. It was a real turning point for me in that conversation. He was really positive. He had this conviction that I would be all right. And again, in the hospital, you know, they were saying, we don't know what's going to happen. We're not sure. We don't know. Hearing someone have that faith in me and that positivity was the key, I think.
Mm.
And eventually he convinced me to go for a coffee with him. I wanted to carry on a conversation with him. I felt I finally had someone I could talk to, you know?
Yeah.
And that was, I hadn't had that before. I guess that was what I needed. That was what I really needed, was that person. Not just to talk to him, right, but to listen, someone to listen.
Yeah.
And he really listens, really listens.
Yeah, and that's what I find so incredibly striking about your experiences. You've got that incredible contrast where the mental health institution that, by the sounds of it, is so pared back in what they're doing that it's really just about binary. Yeah. Are the patients alive or not?
Yeah.
And so all the wonderful things that he did that connected with you are all the things they should have done. You know, that's why it's such a good example of, those are the real ways to save someone's life.
Yeah.
It's not about, let's just watch you, let's take away sharp things.
No.
At some point, you have to get to what's causing this.
And that connection.
Yeah.
And being listened to.
It's treating you as an individual, not a binary digit.
Exactly, You know, every conversation that I had in the hospital was like through a clipboard. Someone would, and on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how do you feel in terms of this? Well, that conversation, rescued me for sure.
Because when you're already feeling so alienated and so stuck, it makes so much sense to me how you came to the decision that suicide was the way out. Because you're in an institution where no one seems to be getting better. You're not offered hope or personal treatment. And so if you're not getting better, what's the only other option?
Exactly, exactly.
And then it becomes this them and us mentality. Mm. And a lot of, even the good mental health institutions seem to breed that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the answer is, but that's why, from what you're saying, the man you spoke to just cut through that.
Yeah.
Because there are all these people trying to stop you doing something, and he's just come along and actually spoken to you like a human. You wanted to push him away too.
Yeah,
he seemed like another person, another one of the them in your way, But then he said a few things that you hadn't seen before, yeah. And that's all it took.
No, it's not. Yeah. It's not rocket science. That's the thing. It's not rocket science. Because myself and Neil, who was the guy on the bridge, we now give talks, and whenever we give talks, people say, "Well, why did you stop? And how did you feel when you stopped?" And I wouldn't be able to do that. And we say, "Yeah, anyone can. Don't have to be a professional to really just listen to someone and just, you know, take that time. It's anyone can do it. That's the thing. It's not. It was just a just an ordinary guy on his way to work and just took that time to have a chat.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because the same people that might say, "Oh, I don't know if I could ever do that," if you reframe the question and said, "Would you spend 5 minutes talking to save a life?"
Yeah, you're right.
They'd all put their hands up for one.
For sure. We talk about a lot of it being fear. Am I going to say the wrong thing? Am I going to do the wrong thing? So Neil talks about, you know, when he came onto the bridge, he saw me in the distance and he was like, "Well, there's a few people in front and one of them will stop." And then he was like, "Oh my gosh, no one's stopping. It's me." And he often reflects back on that, and it's fear. It was fear. I'm gonna say the wrong thing. I'm gonna do the wrong thing. You know, we always say if you just be a human being, and you know, Neil didn't have any training. Everything was just gut instinct, just as you would a friend. You know, if you're there with a friend or family member, and linking it back to people like the Samaritans, for them, they talk about so much of it is listening and not having answers.
Active listening.
And actually, people can often and will often come to their own way of resolving. It's all inside us. And I think it is fear, isn't it? Fear of what if I do the wrong thing?
Right. And luckily, the only times for me I've been in a conversation like that has been in a professional capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to be part of the Samaritans. Mm. I've also worked for the police and I've taken 999 emergency suicide calls.
Gosh.
And they're incredibly different scenarios. I think what I would say to anyone unsure how to start a conversation is you've just got to be the best you can. Like, I could easily say the wrong thing as an officer. I could easily say the wrong thing as a Samaritan. But if you're the one there, you've just got to do the best you can, and that's all you can do.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So you've just got to put that pressure aside because it's just two human beings.
Exactly.
And actually, if you're listening right, you don't have to do much of the talking anyway.
No. That empathy, I think, is really important. And reassurance as well. Like Neil was, okay, you know, don't be embarrassed.
Yeah, and that definitely helps trying to seem a bit more sure of yourself than you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's this expectation that somehow you have to have the answers for that person.
And I know.
You won't. Yeah. It's their life.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can be a listening ear. You can generally pretty easily get the answers out of them.
Yeah.
There's been some interesting things I've heard over the years on reasons to stay alive.
Mm.
And sometimes it's the plant that needs watering.
Yeah.
I only have plastic plants. I can't keep any of them alive. So that would never be my reason.
Okay.
Everyone will have something.
Exactly.
And so frequently, if you just actively listen, they'll come up with it. They'll present it to you. But what about the plant?
Yeah. Unless it's plastic.
And you're like, there's the answer.
I mean, I've used the Samaritans ever since then a number of times. And just to know you'll be met with active listening and that kind of non-judgment, I think that's key, isn't it? The non-judgment. 100%. Again, because in the hospital, it's kind of judged. Oh, you're feeling suicidal. Okay, right. You know, oh, it's not good. Send you back to the suicide ward. I knew every time that I said I was suicidal in the hospital, it would add more to my stay. I'd have to go back to the suicide ward. No one ever wanted to talk about it. And I get it. They need to act in safety, make sure you're safe and quickly take you here and give you this. And they would just put you in the suicide ward, the room, and no one ever talked to you about it.
And there's so many ways you can give that same support without framing suicide or suicidal feelings as an inconvenience.
Yeah, right.
You know, it could be as simple as, because of how you're feeling, let's go to such and such a ward, we'll get you even better support there, rather than, oh, you're not safe here, let's get you over there. it's saying the same thing.
Exactly. I wish you could... you should have that, what you just said. That should be a NHS guideline. Seriously. A lot of it needs to change.
Yeah.
And then also with the police as well, because after he helped me back to the pavement,
right,
we were on the pavement, and then before we knew it, the police sped up in their police car, jumped out, and it was so frantic and really quite aggressive. So I panicked. I panicked when they charged towards me. And it got very, very frantic, and I had to be restrained and handcuffed.
Mm.
I remember the police, again, they just didn't know how to deal with me, because they took me to hospital to be sectioned, local hospital. You know, they wouldn't even sit with me in the A&E waiting room. They stood over the other side and watched me. Again, I think, you know, it comes down to fear and just lack of understanding and training. And
yeah, well, because so much of their training, if they're going on a blue light job to something, they need to jump out, they need to be ready to restrain, to arrest, mm-hmm. whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And as much as training improves, it's one of those tricky situations, because when you're there and the sirens are on, you're in that mentality still.
Right,
and so even though your scenario is so different to going to like a domestic incident or something like that, or, you know, pub fight, whatever it is they're going to, so much of the situation is the same for them.
Yeah,
it's the same priority level.
Yeah.
They've still got to do the same risk assessment, sure. all of the rest of it. And it's so tricky, but there's so much that could change.
Mm.
And when I was training in the police, they knew my background and so invited me to talk people through what to say to someone who's feeling suicidal.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And luckily, I had a few things to say about that, but it really concerned me that I'm not even in the force.
Yeah.
And already I'm like, no, they should. There's a training team.
Yeah.
Why am I teaching this? I'm really glad to actually have that contrast, because the way the Samaritans and the way the police deal with suicide is just polar opposites.
Wow.
And that was really jarring for me as well, because... Yeah. I would go from from being so caller led in the Samaritans to them being in the police, and it's all about get that address, get the officers, route the log, press this key, key, make sure they've got these details, and it becomes a lot more like an interrogation. There's room for both approaches, but there's still room for so much improvement, because for a lot of the calls like that I took, people were calling because they wanted the help now, and they gave the address and they weren't really interested in talking to you about anything else.
Mm.
Whereas Samaritans, the whole reason is
Absolutely.
To talk. So I feel like there must be some kind of medium
Absolutely.
Between these approaches, because equally so many people call the police for the immediate response, and equally so many people call the Samaritans because they want no response.
Yeah. Well, I know some police forces now around the country doing things like they'll go out with mental health nurses, which I think is a much better idea. Or they'll have mental health nurses on call if they're in a situation where someone's in crisis, and they'll be able to talk through with a mental health nurse on the other end of the phone, you know, what approach is best with this. Do you know what I mean? Like,
absolutely. Because as much respect as I have for the officers, if I need medical help, I'm expecting a nurse.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way we're brought up. If the police are coming for you, it's not a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it,
absolutely,
again,
yeah.
is building on that stigma.
Yeah. There's a lot of work that obviously needs to be done. But everyone knows that.
More and more people know that.
Yeah, maybe not everyone, but...
I am so delighted to see all the progress that's been made.
Yeah.
Your experience is so important, because you have that contrast of what it can look like when mental health support is very bad, and what it can look like when you've had so much wonderful support since. So you talked earlier about being in school and just wishing there was someone
Absolutely.
That would have talked about that, would have approached you. It's sort of similar in a way that there was so much focus on grades And then you're in a different kind of institution later on, and then there's all that focus on risk assessment numbers. Yeah. It's not a million miles away. Yeah. It's so wonderful that you've had that full circle moment where you've gone from understanding that what you could have really done with, whether it was school, whether it was university, was somebody who could talk about the experience you were going through, just anybody to voice that so that you knew that it wasn't just you.
Yeah.
And now you've come to a place where you're that person for so many kids.
It's, for me, it's not enough. That sounds really negative, doesn't it? But it isn't. It's not. Yeah, I mean, it's great. I can go into schools and I can be that person. But then if the support's not there, and we know that we've still got a long way to go, particularly, you know, things like CAMHS, you know, really waiting lists at the moment are horrendous. I love going into schools and universities and talking to young people and then having amazing discussions afterwards, people opening up. And there is a lot of awareness now. It's great. Particularly in the last sort of few years, campaigns like Time to Change, and you know, we had Heads Together, and it's great. It's really great. So positive, but that's not matched with the support.
And it's so frustrating when you can see so clearly all of these issues, and then the government approach seems more and more like a shushing. Oh, let's just put this band-aid on, and then people won't complain about it as much. It's like lowering taxes doesn't stop people complaining about taxes.
Yeah. There needs to be like a kind of mental health revolution in terms of services, you know, particularly CAMHS. It's never worked, the whole ending at 18 CAMHS, and suddenly you're an adult, and that gap between CAMHS and the adult mental health services.
Just because you've had a birthday,
right?
Suddenly your support options completely change.
Yeah, exactly. You don't turn into an adult overnight. That's such a critical age, and then so many people fall through that gap between CAMHS and the adult mental health services. And it's just frustrating when you know it could be different. There is a long way to go, but we are moving forwards. And actually, you know, when we look at other countries around the world, at least we are moving forward. Some countries are decades behind us in terms of awareness raising and stigma reduction. So we have to look at the positives.
Absolutely. And so we'll wrap up now. We come to the end of our episode. And so with the episode being all about suicide, is there any kind of last message you'd like to leave if anyone's listening to your experience can really relate to that?
You know, I've been suicidal again, several occasions. It's really horrible. It's very intense and it feels very, overwhelming. And for me, though, the help and the support is there, you know, when you are suicidal. And using particularly, you know, the Samaritans, or there's other helplines and online support, and you will be met with someone that is understanding and non-judgmental. And it just makes such a difference to not to have to hold what's going on to yourself, just to have that chat, whether it be by the phone or email, or even, you know, there's a crisis text line now which is spreading around the UK, to have that conversation and just saying the words, you know, I'm feeling suicidal, I feel like I want to kill myself. I know it's easy for me to say sitting here not experiencing those thoughts and feelings, but just by saying to someone those words, I mean, the difference that it can make, the weight that comes away from your shoulders,
right,
makes such a big difference. So for me, it's all about talking. It is all about talking and not being alone with it. Feeling suicidal for me is no different now to, you know, having a migraine. Or I'll tell someone if I'm having a migraine, you know, oh, I need to lie down, I need to go home, I need to look after myself. Yeah, and it's the brain, isn't it? It's the brain, and the brain is no different to any other part of the body. And, you know, suicidal thoughts and feelings, they're human. They're not your fault. It's okay. You know, not to be embarrassed and speak to someone about it. It's so common. Suicidal thoughts and feelings are so common. No one likes to talk about it, but they're really common. And I think, you know, absolutely, that should hopefully reassure people.
And the final thing I would add to that is that your story isn't unusual. There are so many people that go through this. However, just as important to note is that there's so many people more that survive it.
Exactly.
So true. Just as bad as all the suicide statistics can be, there's far more people like yourself that have survived it and are examples that there is hope. There's always hope.
Yeah.
So we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for talking to me and being so open.
Yeah, thank you.
We really hope you've enjoyed today's episode. It's certainly been one of the most insightful, fascinating ones. Johnny is an absolute delight. I hope you all agree. It's actually our last guest interview of the year. So the next two episodes after this one are going to be two very special end of year episodes. So I won't give any spoilers on what they're going to be like. You'll just have to wait and see. So with Christmas coming up and our last ever guest interview of 2018, I just wanted to mention again our petition. So you'll know that we are petitioning for mental health education to be on the curriculum across the UK in all schools. And that has been doing incredibly well recently. As of recording this, we've passed 170,000 signatures. We've also... You'll gasp.
So excited, so happy.
And we have also started another petition specifically for Wales at the request of the Welsh Assembly. We only need 5,000 signatures for that one to get a debate in the devolved Parliament in Wales. The work will of course continue into the new year, so all I'm asking for today, please go over and sign the petition if you haven't already. You can find that at bit.ly/mentalpetition. The link is in the description for the episode. Also, the most recent update on there has a link to the Welsh petition. You don't have to be from Wales or in Wales to sign that. Yeah, so I guess I'm asking for you to sign two petitions, not one.
I feel like I should try and ask for people to sign it in Welsh language, being from Wales myself, but I think I would offend most Welsh language listeners if I did.
Okay. Yeah, let's not go get offensive. Your Welsh is good to me, but then I don't know any better. So thank you for all the support with the petition so far. We'll continue working for change in 2019. And you can read all about all the progress so far on that same petition page. Thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.